The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to Audio Reads. This week, Fraser Nelson makes the case for why we should be giving citizenship to the Hong Kong Chinese. We also hear from Douglas Murray, who asks why lockdown seems to be exempt for Black Lives Matter protests. And finally, Tanya Gold, our restaurant critic, turns her hand at Monster Munch. First up, Fraser Nelson.
When the fate of Hong Kong was last seriously considered by a British Prime Minister, the world looked very different. It was argued, naively, that not much would change when the colony was handed back to China in 1997. There was a deal that had been struck. Beijing would run only the defence and the customs control, and otherwise, Hong Kong would be self-governing. Now, it was always unlikely that China would honour its promise, but the pretence at the time was pretty useful to a Tory party that was, to its shame, terrified of the alternative, of admitting that Britain had a moral duty to its subjects and to let them stay British, which meant allowing them to settle in the UK if they wished. The deal with China is now in tatters. Beijing has been gnawing away at Hong Kong's liberties for years and is now engaged in an all-out assault. The street protests, which had been going on for almost a year, ended with a COVID lockdown, but China has used the interregnum to come back with its biggest crackdown yet. Last month, it said that Hong Kong will become subject to Beijing's laws on subversion. These are laws currently used to jail Tibetan and Uyghur dissenters. Other crackdowns on free speech are also on their way. So, in other words, we've seen an end to the One Country, Two Systems treaty agreed in the handover, an end to Britain's deal with China, and an end to our ability to dodge the question, what is Boris Johnson going to do now? But the answer, so far, is actually quite a lot. The Prime Minister has offered a full-throated defence of the Hong Kong Chinese with a kind of passion that would have been unthinkable in the coalition years. Back then, George Osborne had a very different policy on China. He wanted to secure as big a slice of his economic pie as possible, getting as many contracts and as much cash back to Britain as he could get away with. And as he knew, there are unwritten rules for a country which... And as he knew, there are unwritten rules for countries who play this game. Never receive a Dalai Lama as a guest, never raise the subject of human rights during foreign visits. The Chinese press actually praised Theresa May for perfecting this peculiar art. Never challenge Xi Jinping's ambition to control China's periphery. And most of all, no support or succour should ever be given to Taiwan, Tibet, or especially the young protesters waving the British flag in the streets of Hong Kong. If any of these rules are broken, then so are relations with Beijing. It is extraordinary just how fast Boris Johnson is dumping David Cameron's policy. He's emerged from the COVID crisis shaken by the extent of Britain's reliance on China, and he's ready to reset relations, even if that means a far harder stance. The Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, has declared China to be in breach of international law with his latest crackdown, and he's talking about Britain's historical responsibilities to the people of Hong Kong. And he's actually given a meaty policy till the end of this. He's letting them come here on a 12-month visa rather than a standard 6 months. This he describes as a pathway to citizenship. It's an offer that applies to almost 3 million people who currently qualify for British national brackets overseas status. This is a kind of passport. It's a consolation prize given to the Hong Kong Chinese, which entitles holders to virtually nothing. It will now mean a bit more, the right to stay here for a year, with the possibility of permanent citizenship dangled tantalisingly. But I'm afraid to say it's still studded with doubt. What would actually happen at the end of 12 months? What does a pathway to citizenship mean? Not very many of the high-skilled migrants Britain seeks are likely to move from one country to another on such a relatively flimsy promise. So Britain's opportunity is to go the whole way and offer full citizenship. That is what we should have done in the first place, and that case can be made anew. We can start with a moral argument made by this magazine 3 decades ago. Hong Kong was only ever Britain's under a 99-year lease. The land itself had to revert. But the people, they ought never to have been parcelled up with them. They ought never to have been handed over to anybody. At the time, the Spectator argued that the Sino-British Agreement of 1984 afforded nobody any real protection. We're giving them nothing in which they can have confidence, the editorial said. Hong Kong is a colony, which means that Britain has an absolute responsibility to its people, particularly as, unlike in other colonies, those people have not actually asked for independence. Full citizenship, we argued, was the only decent offer to make. Now, the pretense that Hong Kong's independence would be respected by the agreement until 2047 was impossible to keep up, even when Boris Johnson was Foreign Secretary. When he was out there commemorating the 20th anniversary of handover, he ascribed the territory's success to a high degree of autonomy as enshrined in the Sino-British Joint Declaration. He was the only one attaching any importance to that. Beijing rubbished it, with a foreign ministry spokesman dismissing this treaty as, quote, a historical document which no longer has any practical significance. Beijing has since been as good as its broken word. 6 years ago, pro-democracy protesters were using umbrellas to defend themselves against the tear gas of the police. The protest failed, but the umbrellas became a symbol of the movement. Beijing has been sending over, meanwhile, increasingly authoritarian legislation for the Hong Kong authorities to approve. There was the extradition law this time last year, which brought 12,000 protesters out onto the streets. Last month, they proposed to make booing the Chinese national anthem punishable by 5 years imprisonment. This is a bit of a problem for the Hong Kong football fans, who've grown quite fond of booing that anthem. Now they can get sent to the gulag if they do so. All of this bodes pretty ill for the future. It's absurd now to think that the Tories were so terrified of granting free movement to just 3 million people in Hong Kong, given that hundreds of millions of EU citizens have had the same right. Britain has since proven itself to be the world's most successful melting pot, integrating 5 million migrants over the past decade, with none of the far-right political backlash seen on the continent. It's pretty hard to argue that there'd be any problem in settling the Hong Kong Chinese, the best educated and the most highly skilled and productive immigrants that any country could ask for. The Brexit debate exposed several misunderstandings anyway about the concern of immigration. It's not that people feel Britain is full. This was a claim made even in 1984 when our islands accommodated 10 million fewer people than they do now. The concern is about the ability to control immigration. And Brexit has brought that control. You can see in the opinion polls, as a result, the concern about immigration since Brexit has plunged. Britain is one of the most welcoming countries in the world, and welcoming Hong Kong Chinese, who were until recently fellow subjects of the Crown, would not be something that would rise anything like public discontent. At a time, anyway, when countries are competing for the high-skilled people, Britain's moral duty and its economic self-interest have become aligned. As one Tory MP puts it, the biggest problem is how many the Hong Kong Chinese we can actually win over here. But Britain, on this front, really is at a disadvantage. The Foreign Office has calculated that those leaving Hong Kong are more likely to go to countries with a large diaspora. Canada and Australia, for example, score pretty strongly on this front, having acted to take in tens of thousands at the time of the handover, when Britain did not. Our behaviour then was pretty bad, and it will have led to a loss of confidence in Britain. That's something we're going to have to make up for now. So perhaps even the offer of full citizenship will not be enough. We should be waiving paperwork fees to underline the fact that this time we really are serious. And there's plenty of precedent for us making this offer. In the 1960s, Uganda's Asians were facing persecution from Idi Amin, who was saying that he'd been told in a dream to expel them. Ted Heath's government then arranged airlifts, and people were then arriving in their thousands in what David Cameron did later described as one of the most successful group of migrations anywhere in the history of the world. Among those newcomers were Sushil and Anjana Patel, whose daughter, Priti Patel, is now our Home Secretary. The parallels between the Hong Kong Chinese and those of other situations are not lost on her, nor on Dominic Raab, whose Jewish father came to Britain from Czechoslovakia to escape the Nazis in the pre-war years. Both of them have been working since September to set up a fast stream solution for Hong Kong. And the way they both see it, this is not just about the fate of a few million people in Hong Kong. This is about Britain's role in the world. One cabinet member put it this way. Look around the cabinet table. There's Dominic Raab, Priti Patel, Rishi Sunak, all children of immigrants who just see this whole question in a different way. That we're looking here at a British tradition that needs to be lived up to. And the Prime Minister, said the cabinet member, has been absolutely rock solid on this. He's been the one leading it. So the funny thing is that the pressure from Tory backbenchers this time isn't to hoist up the drawbridge like it was in Norman Tebbit's day. The pressure is for government to stand behind Hong Kong and not give in to Beijing. To emigrate from Hong Kong requires what they call a certificate of no criminal conviction. Demand for these certificates are now running at 100 a day, a rise of 50% over last year. That's a sign that there might be an exodus pretty soon. Portugal's former Europe Minister, Bruno Macias, has argued in a piece for The Spectator's website that Britain can now make itself a Eurasian capital by welcoming the best and the brightest from Hong Kong. One option, he said, is to use Brexit powers to create Hong Kong-style low-regulation charter cities in Britain, perhaps the north of England, and encourage the same culture of entrepreneurship here. This, he said, could have a two systems, one country system in Britain, just as you do in Hong Kong, and you can merge it with Number 10's levelling up agenda. The opportunities for the human capital here are absolutely huge. But to make the most of them, Britain will have to act, and act fast. You can see why ministers are reluctant to offer full citizenship. A bill would take time to pass Parliament and risk legal challenge from those who say that other migrant groups deserve the same treatment. So the ministers are arguing that right now what they're doing, this plan for 12-month visas along with the offer to a path to citizenship, is a backdoor means of achieving the same result. So why, ministers ask, will we take the harder route of offering full citizenship if that will risk a backlash in Parliament and perhaps in the wider country? I'm afraid to say there's a simple answer to that question. Britain has lost credibility. We let Hong Kong down badly last time. That's why we need to make firm assurances this time. Some argue that an exodus from Hong Kong would actually suit Beijing, removing the pro-democracy troublemakers. Perhaps so, but we can no longer regard them as pawns to be deployed on a diplomatic chessboard. The choice surely should be theirs. And anyway, the past 23 years have shown that Hong Kong is not making China more democratic. Instead, China is making Hong Kong more autocratic, contrary to Britain's promises at the time. That's precisely why the offer of full citizenship should be made now. You can certainly say that Boris Johnson's up for a fight. He's urged China to back down, and he said that Britain is standing ready to act if Beijing pursues its crackdown. But this global Britain agenda, that was his soundbite. It was never really given life when he was Foreign Secretary. Even presenting the option of full British citizenship would empower those who wish to stay, just by letting Beijing know that if they do push things too far, then people will flee Hong Kong just as surely as so many of the island's current inhabitants fled Mao's China. At the time of the handover, The Spectator argued that even the offer of British citizenship would be a powerful form of help because it offers, as we put it, an insurance policy in case the worst comes when Beijing takes over. The worst has not come, at least not yet. Hong Kong still remains one of the most prosperous places in the world. But with Xi Jinping now pushing his authority to the limit, the time has come to offer the full citizenships that were once denied and finally to right an historic wrong.
That was Fraser Nelson. And now, Douglas Murray.
It is nearly 4 years since Black Lives Matter had their first major protest in London. Emulating their US counterparts, the protesters held up their hands and chanted, "Hands up, don't shoot," a chant popularised after the 2014 killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. By then, it had been known for a year that before his death, Brown almost certainly said no such thing and had lunged for the arresting officer's gun before being shot. Still, the London protesters chanted what they believed Michael Brown had said as they processed along Oxford Street, accompanied by unarmed British policemen who couldn't have shot them if they'd wanted to. 2 weeks later, a crowd gathered in Hyde Park chanting "Hands up, don't shoot" and other Black Lives Matter slogans. By the end of the evening, a police officer had been stabbed, 4 other PCs had been injured, and a young man chased into the middle of one of London's busiest streets and set upon by 3 men wielding a machete. It isn't so very far away, this cocktail that is roiling America. But it is one import that we could most certainly do without. Scenes in London last weekend were less dramatic than in America, but after the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minnesota police officer, now under arrest, they simmered in the same atmosphere. That here is a cause so undeniably clear and just that anything, even the law, must bend before it. In the US, protests were swiftly followed by rioting, looting, and burning across the nation. The admirably diverse minority of protesters who have already ruined this cause are ransacking and burning an equally diverse range of targets, black homes and shops among them. For their part, the major corporations appear to believe that the looting of their stores is simply a good opportunity to reaffirm their allegiance to Black Lives Matter, announce the hiring of more diversity officers, and otherwise beg the mobs of protesters and Antifa activists to pass them by. Justin Timberlake and Harry Styles were among the celebrities who committed to pay the legal fees of people arrested. For days, CNN egged things on in similar fashion. Then, last Friday evening, protesters gathered outside the channel's headquarters in Atlanta, graffitied the station's logo, smashed the glass front, hurled projectiles inside, and tried to storm the building as the police held them back and terrified journalists reported live from the lobby of their own workplace. Had the attackers been Trump supporters, the network might have had something to say about it. But over the days that followed, frustration and a sense of not being listened to continued to be trotted out by CNN as the reasons why America was burning. Like America, Britain is still meant to be in corona lockdown. But here, as there, this one cause was granted a mass exemption. On Sunday, thousands of protesters gathered in Trafalgar Square and from there processed to the US Embassy by way of Downing Street, where parts of the crowd stopped to shout "fuck the police" at the men and women on duty. Politicians who spent recent weeks shaming people over their lockdown childcare arrangements seemed supremely relaxed about this. Few even dared to notice. One who did attracted the attention of Dawn Butler MP, who just last month was claiming that Boris Johnson's promise to relax the lockdown was sending people out to catch the virus. On Sunday, the same Dawn Butler harangued a fellow MP who presumed to worry whether the London protest might lead to a second corona spike. "Don't you dare," Butler boomed. "Don't even go there." Our media turned out to share this Black Lives Matter exemption clause. With thousands of people gathered around her, a reporter from Sky News declared, "Of course, gatherings of this nature are illegal at the moment, but people are feeling very strongly about what they have seen in the United States." When the matter of the law was raised to a somewhat theatrical young protester, he declared the virus was something we might not all catch, whereas they are killing people, and so he needed to stop people being killed and beaten up and blown up in the streets. You might say any number of things to that young man if you had a chance. You might ask why the police here are so indistinguishable from the police over there. Whether the police over there are quite what he thinks they are. That, while the violent actions of some US police might be motivated by racism, other factors, not least the heavily armed citizenry, also exist. You might even ask why, when a white American like Tony Timper was suffocated by police in 2016, this same rioting and looting did not kick off. Yet, as with his American counterparts, you can predict the list of claims that would be trotted out. Like other protesters on Sunday, he might try to pretend that Mark Duggan was an entirely innocent man, incomprehensibly shot by the racist British police. And besides, there is Grenfell Tower, the hostile environment, and much more. That whole panoply of untruths and half-truths that have been pumped through our society, all but unopposed, to persuade people to believe that the least racist societies on Earth are in fact the most racist. If you are a public figure, it is very tempting to go along with this, like Timberlake and Styles. But consequences have a habit of catching up with people, as they do with societies. Last Friday, the NBA writer Chris Martin Palmer could be found on social media posting a photo of a burning building in Minneapolis. "Burn that shit down. Burn it all down," he tweeted. A day later, he was denouncing calls for peaceful protests. "That doesn't do anything," he railed. "They don't pay attention until you start burning shit." A day later, Palmer's own neighbourhood was being attacked. "They tried to climb the gates," he gasped on social media. "They had to beat them back, then destroyed a Starbucks and are now in front of my building. Get these animals the fuck out of my neighbourhood. Go back to where you live." Indeed, you have to be careful what you assert at moments such as this. What claims about your society you are willing to mainline. Which lies you are happy to just wave along.
That was Douglas Murray. And now, Tanya Gold.
Now that I have considered Monster Munch, I decide to eat one mindfully. I put it in my mouth, and it is as if I can taste it for the first time. It is repulsive, and I feel cheated. This, then, is an intervention. My husband wrote in these pages that I am always watching spooks and eating Monster Munch. It was a giggle that went on for 400 words. But is eating Monster Munch really so depraved? Doesn't Jay Rayner eat Skips in the darkness when he is alone? Didn't A.A. Gill eat Frazzles? I know I do, but only when I am depressed, which is quite often these days, and then I wish I hadn't. I could say I do it for the metaphor. I will do almost anything for metaphor, and the Walker's Monster Munch pickled onion, "I won't touch roast beef or flaming hot, I am not a monster," is such a good one, I wonder if it is deliberate. Who doesn't want to consume a monster? Who doesn't have one inside them anyway, whispering half lies under their conscious mind? The monster is apparently feet, so it is a bag of feet, which doesn't sound so good. I ate the feet of a monster. This was confirmed by Walker's in the 1970s in a small footnote to food history I found on the internet, which was confirmed by the bag or artifact, miniature monsters with big crispy heads or crunchy claws plucked straight from pickled onion beasts. Nibble the sides or stick your tongue through the hole and let it melt in all its oniony, vinegary glory. The internet is fascinating, unfiltered voices. People ask questions and Google answers them. The questions are pleading and desolate. They amount through repetition to minor tragedy. A Monster Munch healthy? A Monster Munch made from potatoes? A Monster Munch good for you? And, as if asking for tenderness from a narcissist, the answer to everything is no. They are hard to eat. I give them that. So the metaphor in my mouth continues. It isn't easy to eat a dragon, and it shouldn't be. They will, if you have a grab bag, a fine piece of marketing evil, for it insinuates the idea that eating corn snacks is something jaunty, an act of pre-exercise, as if you grab your grab bag and then do 600 press-ups and rise to meet the sun, rather than dying in a puddle of your own fat, strip the skin off the roof of your mouth and leave the flesh behind it hot and raw. As pudding, you can eat your own skin. When some of the corn snacks fall to the floor, the dog sniffs, mildly interested, then walks away. Even the dog won't eat them, and he'll eat anything. I wonder if I do it to feel alive. It is a deadening time pandemic, fear and fire, and what makes you feel more alive than maiming yourself and swallowing your own skin in a socially sanctioned ritual known as snacking? But if it makes you feel alive, it also makes you feel dead. A drug then, a low-grade, lurid, easily available late capitalist drug in the shape of a fictional monster's stinking foot. Trust me, stick with the opiates if you can take the come down. Morphine is what you need now. You can follow the tiny lines of your dreams. Monster Munch, on reflection, just isn't the same. More late Monster Munch information. They used to be called the Prime Monster. So, in 1977, when invented, this snack, it is absolutely not a crisp, was a political attack on James Callaghan. This makes me wonder if, alongside raising Donald Trump in a nappy balloon, activists would like to eat feet-shaped snacks imagined to be attached in life to their preferred nemesis. It would be pleasingly meaningless.
That was Tanya Gold. Thanks very much for listening, and join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.